Welcome to the Big Blue Kickoff Live right here on Giants.com. Joined by the one and only Lance Meadow. I am John Schmelk. 201-939-4513. That's your phone number. A very busy show today. Your calls, and we'll talk to Jimmy Durkin, Raiders beat writer for the Bay Area News Group, coming your way at 12:30 as we do our final AFC West team, the Oakland Raiders. We talked about the Chiefs, Broncos, the Raiders today. And as we move on, and the Chargers, of course, too, moving to Los Angeles. So we move ahead, Lance, with the Giants' schedule. We've talked a lot about the AFC West, and I think the NFC West is a part of the Giants' schedule that I think fans almost see as the soft part of their schedule. And I would caution that to a certain extent, because you never really know year to year how good some of these teams are going
to
be.
Yeah, it's very difficult to go by the results of 2016. I mean, you mentioned some are throwing it out as the soft part of the schedule. I've got the schedule up here, week 5 through week 7, which is the 3 weeks leading into the bye, which is week 8. You've got back-to-back games of the AFC West, home against the Chargers at Denver, and then a tough opponent at home again in Seattle. I mean, that's not an easy stretch for any team, including the Giants. So I wouldn't necessarily describe that as a soft part of the schedule. And then in terms of when they play the rest of the AFC West, Kansas City is in week 11, sandwiched in between San Francisco and Washington. Okay, maybe not as killer as what we just talked about, but then Oakland starts a stretch to close out the season in week 13 on the road, by the way, where then you're home for two key divisional matchups with Dallas and Philly before you wrap up at Arizona and then home against Washington. So those games amongst the AFC West opponents, to me, are right in the middle of very difficult stretches.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think it's the NFC West that I think that fans might see as a bit of the soft landing spots throughout the schedule. You have the Rams in week 9. You have the 49ers in week 10 in back-to-back weeks. Then you have the Cardinals in week 16 and the Seahawks in week 7. In fact, the Giants play three consecutive NFC West opponents around their bye week in week 7, 9, and 10, with week 8 being the bye. And I think teams understandably see some of those teams as weaker. But I want to caution some people about that, because you really never know how good some of these teams are going to be. We're going to talk about that and the AFC West, and we'll preview the Raiders and all that on Giants.com and the Giants mobile app. Go there to watch the entire show right now. We got some phone calls coming, and we'll take those as well, so make sure you check that out. All right, so the NFC West, I think, is interesting, Lance. We've talked about some of these teams. We'll do the Cardinals tomorrow with Jeff Fiegels. And Arizona last year, to me, was one of the teams that were probably better than their record would have indicated. They finished, and we'll talk about this tomorrow on the preview as well, they finished 7-8-1, right? But they had a plus 56 point differential. They were a team that lost a lot of really, really close games. Some key
injuries.
Carson Palmer interceptions killed them. They had injuries. Now, they've had some losses here. Calais Campbell walking away, one of the best defensive players. So that's going to hurt them. But they have a really good running back in David Johnson. I think the Cardinals on December 24th, on Christmas Eve at 4:25, could be a really, really dangerous game for the Giants if people are overlooking that Cardinal team. They're still pretty good.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that they're probably one of the most disappointing teams in 2016,
well, yeah, they
given
went to the
talent.
They went to the NFC title game in 2015
against
and frankly,
Carolina. Yeah.
Almost won that game.
Yeah, and the makeup of that team essentially returned. If you look at the 2015 Cardinals or the 2016 Cardinals.
I'm sorry, they got blown out in that game against
They did. They got blown out,
Panthers,
but the point
they?
Is they still got to the NFC Championship
right.
game.
Correct.
You still have to consider the fact that they went far, and as I mentioned, the nucleus returning. Carson Palmer is surrounded by plenty of wideouts. You mentioned David Johnson is the workhorse in the backfield. And Arizona's always been known to have a pretty good defense,
Absolutely.
Especially when you look at their secondary with some of the key playmakers they have. Patrick Peterson, one of the top corners in the NFL.
The Honey Badger,
Honey
of course.
Badger at safety and corner. He's versatile. So when you take that into consideration, I mean, I would agree with you. I think that's one of the teams, and we were talking about this in one of the features that's going to be up on Giants.com, teams that missed the playoffs last year that the Giants are going to play that could perhaps make the playoffs. I would throw them in with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers conversation. And depending on how the NFC West plays out, that will determine whether or not is Arizona going to just try to have to hold off Seattle? Or are the Rams and the Niners going to surprise us this
Heck,
season?
I really thought Arizona was the best team in the NFC back in 2015. I really did. I thought they were going to beat the Panthers in the NFC title game, which is why I made the mistake I did previously. But I really think that they have a chance to bounce back. But to me, Lance, it's really going to depend on Carson Palmer. Can he have the year he had 2 years ago, or is he going to repeat his struggles from last year? And he actually had a year somewhat similar number-wise, I bet. I'm going to take a look at it now to confirm my suspicions. But I bet you he had a fairly similar statistical profile to Eli Manning.
I know one of the years the interceptions was pretty high. I'm not
correct.
Sure if that was last year or the previous season. I think he had like 22 interceptions, if memory serves me correct.
And why is this ESPN site just
I'll bring it up here.
Carson Palmer
in 2016.
Thank you.
His numbers were 26 touchdowns and 14 interceptions.
Like I said, that's very similar to Eli Manning's statistical profile was last year.
And then I was referring to so it was a little further, but I was referring to the 13 season. Mm-hmm. He had 24 touchdowns, 22 interceptions. Since then, 14 was an injury play campaign. And then the last two seasons, his touchdown interception ratio has not been too bad. 35-11, though,
okay.
The previous season, I thought, was very impressive.
Well, why I think his play is going to really determine how good the Cardinals can be. Is he going to be 35-11, or is he going to be 26-14? It's a big difference.
Yeah. No, also, you jump from 35 touchdowns down to 26. It wasn't so much the interceptions. See, the interceptions didn't skyrocket. It's right. The fact that their passing touchdowns really went down from 15 to 16, and that's a big reason why they weren't a playoff team.
Completion percentage dropped nearly 3%, 400 yards in terms of overall yards throughout the year. So I think Palmer's going to have a lot to do with it. But you're right. Will they have to hold off the Seahawks? The Seahawks have won that division, or I should say made the playoffs the last four seasons or five seasons out of the NFC West. And the Giants are lucky they get to play them at home, and the Seahawks are still a much better home team than they are a road team. Just to give you the numbers, last year for the Seahawks, I believe they finished, if I'm not mistaken, 7-1 at home and 3-4 on the road maybe. I'll have the numbers right in front of me in a second. Yeah, they were 7-1 at home, 3-4-1 on the road. They're one of the teams that had one of those ties. So are the Seahawks going to be able to maintain – their performance, or are you going to see some slippage now as some of the guys on defense get a little bit older?
Well, and also I think there's questions that still remain with respect to their running game.
And the offensive line for that.
Yeah, matter. I mean, that had been such a key part when Marshawn Lynch was there. Now they don't have that. How does that impact the running game? How does that impact Russell Wilson's accuracy?
But with
and like
that,
you mentioned, the defense.
They still went 10-5-1 last year.
They
the
found
question
ways.
Is,
correct.
Or is there going to be slippage elsewhere that really exposes that already present weakness?
Well, I think you bring up an interesting point. My answer to that, John, would be as long as the defense stays respectable, they'll be able to overcome those issues.
Right.
Because that's what did it for them last season. Mm-hmm. If the defense takes a hit, then I think that's the point where Seattle should maybe get a little bit concerned. Right, our offense is not doing as much as we had hoped. Because that was an offense, you were lucky if you got maybe 15 to 17 points out of them at times.
Especially
it was the defense.
Especially in their building.
Yeah, so the defense and the special teams made up for that as long as they don't take a significant hit. Now, I look at that secondary. The safeties are fine. Richard Sherman's fine. To me, the wild card is Deshaun Snead. What do they get out of him production-wise? Is he going to be the guy that will fill the void left behind by some of those other players?
And Shed got hurt at the end of last year, too.
Exactly. He tore his ACL in the playoff game. So that, to me, is the key guy, I think, that will probably determine whether or not this defense holds together.
No question about it. And then, you take a look at the Rams real quick. Last year, they went 4-12, a very disappointing year. And you can point to the quarterback position and, I think, their other skill positions on offense. I mean, their offense last year, quite frankly, you could argue was the worst offense in football. It was brutal. They were ranked below 30 or lower in nearly every offensive category. They started with Case Keenum. We saw what he did against the Giants in London with his 5 interceptions. They had every opportunity to win that game. The offense could never get a point.
Oh, they were constantly knocking
it
on the door in that game.
Absolutely. You take a look at the offensive line. They had to move on from Greg Robinson, who was the second overall pick in the draft. They made some additions in free agency to try to shore up that group, see if you can get Todd Gurley going. After a promising rookie season, Todd Gurley was brutal last year. And now Jared Goff is the quarterback. And it looks like they've made some additions to the wide receiving core, which, quite frankly, was a mess for them for a very long time. They didn't help their quarterback at all with that wide receiver core. They lose Kenny Britt. They bring in some young guys. So can that offense go from the 31st or 32nd ranked offense to the 23rd ranked offense, the 24th ranked offense? If they can do that with that defense they have, if they protect the football on offense, they can get, I think, to 7 wins, and they can be a respectable team with that defense as good as it is in Los Angeles. So I think that's going to be an interesting team to see. Are they going to be another bottom feeder, or are they going to try to inch closer to to 500. I think a lot of it has to do with how much better Goff is in a new offense under McVay, and we'll see how that goes.
And how far along those young receivers come, as you mentioned, because Kenny Britt, if you go back, he was by far one of their best wide receivers, even more impressive than Tavon Austin at times.
He had a good year last year.
That's a big reason why he turned it into a contract with Cleveland. Yep. So Tavon Austin, when you look at their roster, he's almost the most experienced commodity.
He is.
Everybody else has really been a draft pick over the last few seasons.
And he's not even a real wide receiver.
He's more of a jack-of-all-trades.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah,
you can run him out of the backfield, use him as a screen guy. He's not necessarily that deep vertical threat. But if you get him out in open space, he's extremely dangerous.
Sure.
You got to give them credit for that. And Gurley is also dangerous in open space. You brought up the defense. There's a lot of things I like about the Rams' defense, especially their front four. And then there's a lot of things that I sort of cringe at with respect to their defense, and it's the secondary. So that's why, to me, John, when I talk about the Rams defense, I almost say it's Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, which is one of my favorite phrases, because there were games last season, I remember you'd watch the Rams, you'd be like, boy, this is a tough group to score on. And then there'd be games where they would give up 30 points in the blink of an eye.
So, absolutely right.
So my question is, which Rams defense is going to show up more consistently this coming season? And that's going to determine, like you said, how competitive the Rams are going to be.
Absolutely. And then you have the 49ers, and folks, I don't want to be mean and nasty here, but this is a rebuilding year for the Niners. New general manager, new coach. They're going to have to figure things out. They don't really have a starting quarterback that you know is going to be there and be the future.
An answer.
They're still figuring that out. Carlos Hyde, we'll see if he's even there by midseason. Rumors are they were trying to move him. They drafted Jamal Williams, the running back. I'm trying to remember who they're. They drafted one of those middle round running backs. I don't quite remember which one it was.
I think it was Nick Mullins, who maybe you're referring to. That was one of
the
guys that they
drafted.
Joe Williams.
Yeah,
yes, they
Joe
did.
Williams,
at Utah.
Joe Williams.
Yeah.
Thank you. I remember if it was Joe or Jamal. They drafted one of the two guys who they think could be a player. But I mean, their wide receivers are a mess. I mean, they don't have anybody that's really established in the NFL, and their defense has still a couple remnants from those good defenses from a few years ago. But it's not the same. So the Niners,
they did have a nice draft, though, from a defensive
they
standpoint.
They did, absolutely, right? And I think John Lynch
quality.
Did a really good job turning the picks he had into more picks and taking advantage of that value. So I agree with you, but this is going to be – and look, they committed to John Lynch and the head coach, what, 5 or 6 year contracts, right? I think maybe 6 years even, which is unheard of in the NFL, giving guys that long of a deal. So they understand this is a process, so I wouldn't expect a ton out of them this year.
Well, I think you bring up a good point about the receiving core. I mean, that's probably the first thing that jumps out. They do have two veterans in particular, Pierre Garçon as well as Jeremy Curley, but the problem is Garcon's not a vertical threat. He's more of a possession wide receiver. So who's going to be the guy that's going to be able to be that vertical threat this season for the San Francisco 49ers? Not that Brian Hoyer is a guy that's going to air it out, but you always need that because that's the way you open up the running game and you open up things in the middle of the field for your tight ends and your possession wide receivers. So, you know, that's obviously a big question mark for San Francisco. I think there's going to be a team that probably makes strides on the defensive side of things before they make strides on the offensive side of things, and they'll hope that if they get that defensive identity back. Remember, when Harbaugh was the coach, people talk about Kaepernick, but that was a defensive-minded team. This was a team that went up against the Giants in the NFC Championship game. That was the defense that
Kaepernick
did the heavy lifting.
Had a couple of explosive games here or there, but they won because of Patrick Willis. They won because of Navarre Bowman. They won because of Justin Smith. They won because of Aldon Smith. That's why they won all those games. You're
Deshaun
absolutely
Goldson,
right. Yeah, exactly. And that's why I think people argue that they should have just stuck with Alex Smith to win with the defense, and like the Chiefs are doing with them now, to be quite frank with you. But of course, and the funny thing is that everyone thought, and I agreed with them. Me and Dettino talked about it all the time. I think we talked about it too on the air. They had done such a great job stop piling picks. They had like 9, 10 draft picks seemingly every year, multiple twos, multiple threes. And boy, they did not take advantage of all those selections. For them to have as much of a dearth of talent as they do, I think is a pretty good explanation as to why the old regime is gone. And I think once they let go of John Harbaugh, he was the linchpin holding that whole thing together. Everything kind of just fell to pieces.
Now, with that being said, I agree with you. It did hurt. Chris Borland was a great draft pick, and then he decides to retire.
So no question.
You're not expecting that to happen.
Agreed.
And that was a key component. And then Patrick Willis, early retirement, too, because of the toe issue.
And Navarre Bowman blew out his knee.
So those are unforeseen. But my counter to that would be, which is what your point was, you have to have depth so that when these things do happen, you don't all of a sudden get caught off guard. The other thing to note with San Francisco, I mean, you brought up the Alex Smith and 2020's hindsight, but I remember, and I vividly remember this game, John, Kaepernick made his debut on Monday Night Football against the Bears because Alex Smith was hurt. Kaepernick ran circles around what was a great Bears defense at the time. That was when they had all of those key guys.
Urlacher,
Lance Briggs,
yeah.
Tim Jennings, Peanut Tillman. Everybody was still around. And, you know, Harbaugh, like any coach, you get excited. You see what's happening. He catches them off guard. But Alex Smith was still the consistent guy. He wasn't turning the ball over. They were winning. They were playing smart football. And then you see what he's doing in Kansas City, as you mentioned. I understand it's easy to say that now, but I remember at that time, I always said the smart thing is stick with the guy.
You're always
that's been
a big
consistent.
Alex Smith guy. I remember
and
that.
I still to this day am.
I know you are.
Because I'm not that guy that jumps to go towards the sexy thing. The sexy thing is Kaepernick. But to me, it's about the fundamentals. And Alex Smith, I understand people are critical. He doesn't have the strong arm. He doesn't throw deep down the field. But you know what? The Niners were winning, though. And don't results count for something?
Hey, Dave, I don't know about you. I always thought of Lance as somebody that loves to jump at sexy things. That's
well,
just
now
me.
You guys are reading too much into everything I say. See, this is what happens on this program. I throw out one term, and then all of a sudden it blows up to Pandora's box.
201-939-4513. We'll be joined by Jimmy Durk. Durk in to talk about the Raiders and the Bay Area News Group in about 10 minutes. Your calls until then. Let's go to Justin in Massachusetts on line 4. Mr. Dominic, what's up? Justin, how are you?
Hello. How are you guys doing today?
We're great. How are you, sir?
Good. Yeah, I sound a little young.
You sound fine, Justin. Go ahead.
No worries.
You
we're not judging
good.
You.
You sound good. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm a little young. I've been a Giants fan since, like, 04, really when Eli got drafted.
Okay.
And overseeing his career and seeing what the Giants did this offseason, I really like how they got him more red zone targets. And also onto the schedule, the PFF came out with their front sevens ranking, and the 49ers were at the bottom of their list, but they said, like, they're more underrated. But, I mean, this is up to you guys. You guys can discuss those two topics.
I appreciate it, Justin. I'll hit on your second one first. I didn't see the front seven rankings. The Niners
I'm sorry. It's next week. I listened to their podcast this morning.
So they were teasing and previewing what they're going to publish.
I did see them put up on Twitter, and Lance, I was going to mention this, whether or not they put up, I guess it was a question,
graphic.
I guess, and
with a graphic.
And the graphic would basically showed the Giants' defensive line with all the grades. Lance has it in front of him. He can go into details. The numbers for the grades don't really matter because they're abstract. But they basically asked, is the Giants' front four with Vernon, Harrison, Pierre-Paul, and they're assuming Dalvin Tomlinson is going to be the starting defensive tackle next to Snacks, is that the best run-stopping front four in the NFL? And my answer, quite frankly, is yes. I think it is. You might have a better pass-rushing defensive line. I don't think you have a better run-stopping defensive line. I really don't.
Well, and all the grades are impressive, and that's if you want to put stock in these grades, of course. Just to put things in perspective here, they had Olivier Vernon 14th out of 109 players at that position, JPP 13th out of 109. So you're talking about two guys in the top 15 at the defensive end position.
And that's only against the run, by the way.
Yes,
correct.
In stopping the run. That's important to note. And then Snacks was 7th out of 127 players.
I'm surprised he was 7th. I'm surprised he wasn't 1.
Or top 5 at least. Yeah. And then Dalvin Tomlinson doesn't have a ranking, nor should he, because he's a rookie. Now, I tweeted that tweet out and then quoted. I said, the one guy, though, I wouldn't overlook, and I'm not saying that Pro Football Focus is not doing his homework, but I still think there's a very good chance Robert Thomas could very well solidify that starting job next to Snacks.
It.
And then Tomlinson gains a bigger role as the season goes along, which means that they would then have more of a veteran. Now, I'm not trying to say that that's going to make the Giants' run-stopping abilities that much better if Thomas is there as opposed to Tomlinson, but I just don't – I wouldn't pencil in at this point that assume Tomlinson is definitely going to be the guy next to Snacks.
And that, by the way, is how they handled Hankins. That's how they handled
Correct.
Linval Joseph.
Moved him
that's
along
how
slowly.
They handled Barry Colfield. They yeah. bring these. They don't. They'll start at some point in their rookie year, but they're not going to get thrown in right away,
right out of the gates. And I would agree with you. I mean, I think when you have 3 out of 4 guys on the defensive line, because the fourth player is going to be a question mark, no matter who he is. We haven't seen much on the field. You'd be hard pressed to find other teams in the NFL right now, if you want to at least just focus on the NFC, that have 3 out of 4 of their defensive linemen who are solid against the run. They may have more explosive pass rushers.
Yeah.
Or defensive tackles that can get to the quarterback more effectively and consistently than a guy like Snacks. But once again, I think you'd be very hard-pressed to find 3 out of 4 that are that stingy in stopping the run.
Hell, I mean, just to get a little bit more specific, I know we're kind of getting off of Justin's point here, but I think the defensive end combination alone, I mean, I'm not sure if you want to count the Chargers, but Bosa and Ingram is both defensive end. I think Ingram's technically an outside linebacker and will go down a nickel. I guess the Seahawks with Avril and Michael Bennett. Who else would you put up there, Lance, as a better defensive end combination than Vernon and JPP? I don't think you can find one. I really don't.
Yeah, it probably would be difficult. I mean, off the top of my head, I'm trying to think.
I mean, if you want to go, if you want to count Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware from last year, but again, I think Von Miller is technically an outside linebacker that rushes on third down.
Well, it's the same thing because in my head, I'm thinking of Khalil Mack, who I'm very high on, but Mack's a linebacker too.
Right. Until you get the passing downs, then he puts
his hand. So, I mean, I guess the question would be, do you want to treat it as most impressive pass rushing combos or most impressive defensive ends? If your question was defensive ends, John, then I think JPP and Vernon are going to be tough to top.
I agree.
If it's best pass rushing combos, that means you could take into consideration DEs and linebackers.
Different question.
Then I think that you're going to probably have more competition there.
I agree with that. Justin, I forgot. What was your first question? We kind of went off on a tangent here.
I'm saying that the Giants got more red zone targets for Eli because they really struggled in the red zone. And I remember just looking at the screen, just yelling, like, just score some points so the defense can relax. I'm just like, oh.
Hey, look, the red zone offense last year I wasn't as bad as I think people think it was. But I will say this. In my opinion, Brandon Marshall's presence will help an awful lot. Evan Ingram's presence will help an awful lot. Two tall, talented wide receivers that give Eli Manning big targets down there. But, you know, even in addition to Eli Manning getting more tries in there and getting more targets to receivers, I think running the ball inside the five and inside the 10 is going to make all the difference. I think that's the most important thing. And once you start running it, guess what? You can use play action. You can do play action bootlegs. You can move the quarterback. You can do a million different things once you show you can punch the ball in short yardage. So I think that's step one before you start worrying about throwing it down there. Thanks for the call, Justin. We appreciate it.
I mean, I think that's a key point, and I appreciate the phone call, Justin. You've got to get teams to respect the running game, not just throughout the field, but also in the red zone. Give them a reason to put more guys in the trenches to prevent the Giants from getting opportunities on the ground. And if the Giants can be effective within the 5-yard line in those short yarded situations, now all of a sudden you have to account for that, John. So like you said, if you go play action, now you're going to have probably favorable matchups in the corner of the end zone. And you could set up some fade plays here or there. I think that makes you much more dimensional as opposed to a one-dimensional type of offense, which was at times showcased in the red zone specifically, where you knew, all right, they were going to be throwing the football because they didn't have a lot of faith and confidence in the ground game.
Absolutely. 201-939-4513. Pardon me. Nick in Meadowlands will be our last caller before we get to Jimmy Durkin from the Bay Area News Group. What's up, Nick? How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing great. How are you, sir? What's going on today?
I was going to tell you about, you know, another congratulations. You're getting close, right?
Yeah, I am officially on. That's why I have my phone in front of me the last week or so of shows. Seriously. We went to the doctor this morning. Everything is good. She is due on August 3rd. I am on high alert, and we'll see what happens.
Yep, the clock is counting down.
Yes, sir.
So, with the names, I was going to help you. It's not that hard.
Oh, boy.
You know?
All right, what do you got?
I have two daughters, you know, so they just reached teenagehood now. You know, they're in the teenage years now.
Oh, but, God bless and
you know,
good luck with that.
My first daughter, Madeline, you know, Madeline Stowe, when I was growing up, the actress, I always said, I love that name when I have a daughter.
Now, Nick, right away, there's a Madeline that works here with the Giants in the building. I can't do that.
Yeah, well, you
this
know,
is the problem. I have.
It's a nice short name, Maddie.
Yeah,
but then my second daughter was even easier. I took, you know, thought of my mother, the Irish side, you know, and I said, I got to give her an Irish name. Caitlin, Katie, you know, Kat for short. She likes to be called Kat, and that's it.
Katie's my wife's name.
It's just the wife makes it hard, you know. She doesn't agree. My wife was pretty easy when it came to
Yeah, honestly, you know what, Nick, and it's funny. My wife is better. She had more ideas for names than I did. I was vetoing stuff left and right. I said this when I was on with either the Tino or Fiegel's, Lance. I don't think I was on with you. The problem you run into is that you end up having these points of reference for all these names, people that you knew, people that you worked with, names from characters in TV shows you don't like.
Don't think too much about it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
go with your gut feeling, you know.
You know, we have one.
Go with the gut feeling.
We have a name. It's secret. It's a good name. I've never
don't
met
let somebody
any...
else name it.
Never
name, name the name, you know, in-laws, you know, mother's
no,
father.
Never.
Don't let that happen.
I never met anybody that had this name before, but it's not
wow,
like
okay.
but it's not like a freak show name either. So it's a
so
good
it's not
name.
A fruit is what
with.
You're
about,
telling me? You're not naming
about,
your kid Apple?
How about Nevaeh? Heaven spelled backwards.
Boy, that's really crafty thinking.
That is. I'm surprised Lance hasn't suggested Meadow. It's a hell of a girl.
That
name.
Is a good name. That's true. Yes.
Meadow's a great name.
That
too.
Is a very
Autumn,
good name.
Meadow.
Absolutely. Of course, you're going to probably put the A in. So, you know, the way to really truly spell it is without the A. But that's a whole other story. We can have that on another program.
Nick, do you have a Giants point before we say goodbye, by the way? I guess not.
The training camp coming up. I want to go as many times as I can. Do I have a chance at Landon Collins or DRC signing some jerseys for my daughters? Or do you know how does that work?
They have again. I don't have the schedule, and they're not going to publish the schedule. I'm not going to be able to give it to you. But every practice that's open to the public, a position group will go to sign for kids. So if you bring your daughters and they go into the kids section and they have their jerseys to sign, and you happen to get lucky and you show up on a day that the safeties are signing and the cornerbacks are signing, you can get them to sign them. Absolutely.
Yeah, they'll release when the legend players are going to be out there signing.
But that's going to be a 50-50 chance,
well,
right?
Well, Nick, well, actually, it's less than 50-50 because you got more than two position groups. But the problem with it is, and I'm being really serious now, when they announced who was going what days the quarterback would go or the day the wide receiver would go because people want Eli and Odell so badly – the thing would get overrun.
Yeah.
It would create a dangerous situation where people can get injured because people like rush the gate and stuff like that. So that's why they don't identify who's coming out on a specific.
That makes
week.
A lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And some snack said the other day, he made a great point on NFL Network, and I've told you guys, and you guys already know it. They're not going to be able to double team Odell. So
it'll be hard.
Well, it will all depend on what the other players around him do as well.
The running game does show up. I really do hope so, because that's an even better, you know, sweet piece of the pie right there, you know.
All right, Nick.
Things will really happen then.
Listen,
the red zone will be taken care of with those two big guys down there, I'm pretty sure.
Nick, before we let you go, it is important, though, that you let us know on this program what day you're going to show up just so that we have extra security in place. So we'd appreciate you giving us a heads up.
To you guys. I'm going to show you my New York Giants tattoo. I represent for life.
You know, Lance loves tattoos. So if you want to show somebody tattoos, it's Lance.
I'm like David Deal. I got a whole sleeve of tattoos, so he can have a field day looking at them.
All right, Nick.
Lance's whole back is actually a portrait of himself. It's a self-portrait. So it's great.
Yes.
I appreciate the call. Thanks,
right, Nick.
Thanks,
appreciate
Nick.
The Take phone care. Call.
It's you actually prancing in a meadow. It's
absolutely.
Very,
you know me way too well.
It's very fitting.
There can never be enough mirrors around.
All right, it's time for our guest. Let's go to Jimmy Durkin, Raiders beat writer for the Bay Area News Group. Jimmy, you got John Schmelk and Lance Meadow here in East Rutherford, New Jersey. Good morning. Thanks for waking up a little early for us today. How you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks for taking some time out during your time off. You know, for people that cover the NFL, this is kind of the time of year where everyone gets to take a deep breath, take a little vacation. We appreciate you giving us a few minutes. And I think Raider fans, putting the move aside, we'll get to that a little bit later in the interview, I think they've got to be super optimistic over the potential results this year. I think they could have challenged for the AFC representation in the Super Bowl if Derek Carr doesn't get hurt last year. I think the offense could be even better this year with the addition of Marshawn Lynch and Jared Cook. How optimistic is the Raider fan base going into this year?
Well, I mean, it's the Super Bowl aspirations are certainly there. I mean, I think last year, you know, the shame about last year with Carr getting hurt is that, you know, they didn't really get a playoff run. I mean, they get one playoff loss where Connor Cook starts. And, you know, they didn't really get to get an actual taste of how this team stacks up. And so they're, you know, that kind of gives you reason to be overly optimistic almost because you don't feel like you had a real shot last year. But now with Carr back, you talked about the Jared Cook addition. Everyone's looking at Marshawn Lynch. And, you know, he, to me, still is such a question mark. You don't know what he's got left.
But, I agree.
Jared Cook, I think, is going to be huge just because as good as Amari Cooper and Michael Crabtree are as a wide receiver combo, they needed a third guy, and they haven't got a whole lot out of the tight end position. And so to have a guy over the middle that they can get involved, I think having a third weapon for Derek Carr, and you know, he might have a couple more if Cordarrelle Patterson emerges as a guy on offense. But Cook is going to really help this offense be so much better. I mean, we know they've got a great offensive line that can pass block and run block for him. And, I mean, if you give Carr more weapons, you know, the sky's the limit, it seems like, with him.
Well, I agree with you, Jimmy. I think the addition of Jared Cook, certainly a big bonus, especially when you look at what he did for the Green Bay offense last season when he was healthy and on the field. You mentioned Marshawn Lynch is still somewhat of a question mark. They did lose Latavius Murray in free agency. He signs with the Vikings. They have a few options behind Marshawn Lynch, at least on the depth chart, Jalen Richard, as well as DeAndre Washington.
And rookie Elijah Hood, by the
correct.
Way.
Correct. So if Lynch is not necessarily the workhorse this season, how do you see the running game playing out, Jimmy, in the absence of Latavius Murray?
You know, I think you want to give Marshawn kind of the carries that Latavius got last year. I mean, there were times Latavius had, you know, 5, 6, 8 carries in the game. You know, I don't know that Marshawn will ever be that low, but I mean, I don't think you're going to see him exceeding the 15 to 20 carry mark really all that often, if ever. And I think you're going to want to give Jalen Richard and DeAndre Washington opportunities, give them, you know, 5, 7, 8 carries a game. Those are guys that both were up near 500 yards rushing as rookies. And they like them in the passing game as well. You know, maybe not as they don't have the size, so they're not as good as pass blockers. But those are guys that are going to want to get involved, and that's what you hope helps Marshawn Lynch, because he doesn't need to take a huge pounding. If they can kind of, you know, ease him in to games, and then in the fourth quarter when defenses are starting to tire, let him kind of use his big physical body to beat guys up, and then also be their guy around the goal line to find the end zone. I think that's your ideal mix. And if he gets, you know, 175 to 200 carries, you know, maybe averaging 12 to 15 a game, I think that's a nice little sweet spot for him, and they can be productive like that.
I'm not trying to take anything away from Amari Cooper. I think he's a wonderful player. He's had two very good years. But do you think this is the year that he takes that next step into that upper tier of wide receivers in the, you know, A.J. Green category, where he gets to 1,400 yards and double-digit touchdowns? Because I know he's kind of battled a bunch of nagging injuries his first 2 years, right?
Yeah, I mean, his first year was really like the last month of the season. His
right.
foot, he could barely run. Last year, he was healthy. He just, you know, he slowed down. His production disappeared in the second half of the year. And that's what you need to see out of him. You need to see him be able to go full 16 games. You need to see him be able to find the end zone more. I know in the red zone, Carr does tend to trust Crabtree a little bit more, and that's why Crab's touchdown numbers are a little bit higher. But, you know, they do need to see him be able to just show that the guy that burst onto the scene the first half of the year and is looking like he's on his way to a 1,500-type season, that he can keep that going. And I think just seeing him a little bit during the spring, during the offseason program, he looks like he's bulked up, kind of added to that body. You know, I think he understands that he needs to be, you know, be in better shape to be able to kind of handle the grind of that whole season. And so he's a smart guy. He knows how to, you know, he figures out his weaknesses really quickly and does a good job addressing them. His rookie year, he had a huge issue with drops, and it was a big topic. And, you know, he was able to address that in his second year, didn't drop as many passes. But early in his second year, he was struggling on the boundary plays. He was not able to drag his toe and be able to make those sideline catches. We talked to him about it. He said, yeah, I need to work on that. And it was like a week later, he's making toe drag catches. So he understands, he's very good at understanding what are his weaknesses and quickly addressing them. So it'll be interesting to see how he does that in year three.
Talking with Jimmy Durkin, Raiders beat writer for the Bay Area News Group. And Jimmy, one of the things you brought up was the fact that the Raiders had always been looking for that consistent third option, and that's why the addition of Jared Cook is key. And I think when people look at teams, they tend to get caught up in the names. And you just talked about Amari Cooper, Michael Crabtree, named commodities, but one of the members of the receiver corps that actually jumped out to me last season watching from afar was actually Seth Roberts, who I thought proved to be a nice complementary piece. How much progress do you think he will make this offseason to perhaps become more of a consistent weapon, so that maybe when you look at the Raiders, it's not just a 1-2 punch in the receiving corps, but it's actually three guys that are much more consistent?
You know, he is under, I think, a little bit of pressure, because he's got an incredible stat out there. The Raiders, I think, are 9-0 whenever he catches a touchdown. So he's a guy that's been clutch. He's had like four or five game-winning touchdown receptions in his last 2 years. But his last month, his last, you know, 8 games of the season, I think,
he basically averaged like 1.7 catches for, I think, 17 yards. He did nothing for him late in the year, and that was a big issue. He was a guy that had big issues with drops. They had a big game in Kansas City on a Thursday night where he was targeted 9 times, had only 2 catches for 12 yards. And that's a huge issue. I mean, he needs to be able to be more consistent. He needs to hold on to the ball. And I think with adding Patterson as a guy that they want to be their kick returner but is going to push him for that number 3 job, if he's under pressure to show that he can be a consistent target, that he can get open, they like a lot of the stuff he does. He's going to have to play more special teams now with a guy like Andre Holmes, who left and went to Buffalo. And so he's going to have to play more special teams. He's a guy they love as a run blocker. He's probably their best run-blocking wide receiver. But he's going to have to just kind of figure out, like Cooper, how to keep that production going into the second half of the year, because he was very good in the first half, and then he faded. And that was a big reason why their offense started to fade toward the end of the year.
And, it's funny. You talk about all these weapons, you're throwing it around the park, and that's all great, but none of this would work if it wasn't for the great play of the offensive line. And all 5 guys from last year are back. Donald Penn, left tackle, Kelechi Osemele at left guard, Rodney Hudson at center, Gabe Jackson at right guard, 4 excellent players. Right tackle, however, do you think it's going to be Austin Howard again, or do you think Marshall Newhouse, former Giant, by the way, has a chance to usurp him at that right tackle spot?
Yeah, Newhouse is the guy that would be considered the leader in the clubhouse. Howard had shoulder surgery at the end of last year. He still has not been fully cleared to participate. And, he's going to probably be facing an uphill battle, maybe even to make the roster, just because they've got some young guys that they've drafted over the last couple of years, in some of the later rounds, even a 4th rounder this year, and David Sharp, that I think eventually they need to kind of find who are the young guys, who are the cheaper guys that are going to be able to step into that offensive line with all the money that they've doled out to Jackson, Osemele, and Hudson.
Right.
It's probably going to be Newhouse. He's the guy that they would be looking most to. If not, there's a couple of young guys in Vidal Alexander, David Sharp, I mentioned, Denver Kirkland. Austin Howard would be nice to have around as kind of a veteran backup that can play multiple positions. But right now, I would expect Newhouse to kind of join that group.
Jimmy, on the flip side, when you look at the defensive line, this seems to be an offseason where most of the additions to the Raiders were more on offense as opposed to defense. It seemed they lost some personnel, and that doesn't mean that they lost key players. I think a lot of that was based on how money was thrown around, and some players may have been overpaid for their production with Oakland. But what's the outlook for this front 7 specifically before we get to the secondary? There's Khalil Mack. There's some linebackers here or there, but it doesn't seem like there's a lot of key playmakers to complement Khalil Mack. What do you make of this group in the front 7?
Yeah, it's a concern because it wasn't, even with Khalil Mack last year, they weren't great. I mean, they have the defensive player of the year, and they were last in the league in sacks and near the bottom of the league in defense. So they need guys that are there to play better. The big name to watch is Mario Edwards Jr. He was a guy that had a promising rookie year 2 years ago that got cut short with a neck injury. And then last year, first preseason game, first quarter, he injures his hip and ends up basically missing the whole year. He returned the same night, Christmas Eve, that Derek Carr got hurt. He played a little bit the last couple games and into the playoff game. But he's a guy that they love as a versatile guy that can, play – he can play defensive end. He can kick inside in the sub package, and they really need to find. They need him to be healthy to help them get some interior line push because they didn't get any of that last year. They cut Dan Williams, who had a pretty unproductive year. They didn't get much out of their second round pick, Jahad Ward, who now is just coming off foot surgery that's going to keep him out of the start of training camp. So they need to hope that a healthy Mario Edwards Jr. makes an impact. Maybe third-round pick Eddie Vanderdoes is a guy that can come in and do something. But it's a little bit of a concern right now because you've got Khalil Mack, you've got Bruce Irvin on the other side of him, and if Mario Edwards Jr. is good, then you're solid there. But you've got some question marks elsewhere because the linebacker play was bad last year. They let Malcolm Smith go, because he didn't have a great year, but they didn't really do much to replace him or really go out and find some new pieces. They waited till the 5th round to finally draft a linebacker in Wake Forest, Markel Lee. I mean, he's a guy that as a 5th round pick could step right into a starting job because they don't really have anybody else. So it's the biggest question mark for sure facing this team.
Yeah, and it looks like in terms of that linebacker core, and I'll follow up on that very quickly, they bring in Jelani Jenkins to take one of those spots over Corey James, who I believe was a backup last year, right? He's going to move in as a starting spot. Perry Riley's out the door. Do they think that Jenkins and James can do enough to complement Mack and Irvin to give you at least a little bit at that second level in terms of playmaking?
You know, I don't think any starting job is anywhere close to being settled.
Okay.
You know, Mark, you know, the way they roll with rookies is you're going to have to fight your way in. So I think Markell Lee is going to get some real looks. There's a Tyrell Adams that's been getting a lot of first team reps. You know, Jenkins probably has the edge at the weak side linebacker spot. You know, and we'll see kind of how James progresses. I think he's a guy that needs to add some size, but they still could bring back Perry Riley Jr. He's still sitting around as a street free agent. He's kind of waiting for them to up their offer. I think they still have some interest in him, but they're going to be scouring the waiver wire when teams start cutting their roster, and they could look to add at that position.
Talking with Jimmy Durkin, Raiders beat writer for the Bay Area News Group, and one of the other things that jumped out to me in terms of the defensive statistics last year, Jimmy, was the fact that the Raiders struggled in stopping the pass, 24th in yardage per game. Now, they invested two draft picks this year in two young guys, and I think they got good value in terms of Gary Conley and Obi Melifonwu. How much of a role do you think those two will have, even though they still have some veterans in the mix?
Yeah, I mean, I think Conley comes in, assuming obviously that his case gets cleared, and they're still waiting to find out about that. But assuming his case gets cleared, I think he comes in and is probably right away their nickelback. You know, he can come in this year and kind of learn the job, learn that role. And, you know, and if one of the other guys ahead of him, Sean Smith or David Amerson, if they struggle like they did last year, Conley's going to have a chance to kind of step into that starting job. If not this year, then next year when they can kind of walk away from either of those two contracts. So, I mean, he's going to be out there a lot. We all know that a nickelback is pretty much a starting job nowadays. As far as Melifonwu goes, they're really looking at him as a guy. They've struggled over the years defending tight ends. They just, I mean, consistently are letting tight ends go free over the middle. They think he's a guy, he's really long. He's got a lot of size and speed. They think he's a guy that can come in and help them shut down tight ends. I think you're going to see a lot of setups where they've got six DBs out there. You know, Melifonwu almost might kind of be, you know, somewhat of a linebacker safety hybrid at times. But I think you're going to see a lot of times where you have kind of the four starting DBs of Smith, Amerson, last year's first rounder Carl Joseph, and then Reggie Nelson, along with bringing those two guys in, and they hope that they are able to kind of match up with the slot receivers and the tight ends better than they have in recent years.
From a big-picture perspective on the defense, it seems as though the Raiders understood after free agency where they made some additions on offense that, look, we need to bring some guys in to help this defense out. So five out of their first six draft picks were all on the defensive side of the ball at different levels. And they have a decent mix, I think, of young guys and veterans. How much is the Raiders' success on defense this year going to depend on young players improving throughout the year with experience? So maybe the unit might not look good in week one or two, but they hope by week 9 or 10, with some games under their belts, this unit will be a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to take guys like Carl Joseph kind of coming into his own and really, you know, he was a guy that he missed four games at the end of last year, and they didn't start him for his first two games last season as well. But when he was out there, was pretty good, but doesn't make a whole lot of flashy plays. They maybe need a few more flashy plays out of him. They need a couple of young linebackers to step up. They need somebody on the defensive line, whether it's Edwards, whether it's Ward, whether it's a Darius Latham. They need those guys to just kind of gradually get better. Somebody has to have a big year out of that group. And then, you know, a guy like Reggie Nelson, who made the Pro Bowl last year at safety, but really I don't think had a very good year. I mean, he's a guy that's a ball hawk, had five interceptions, I believe. But there was the big kind of buzzword for the Raiders was they had poor communication in the backfield, and that's what led to them leading the league in deep passes allowed. One thing they hope helps there is they brought in John Pagano, who was the defensive coordinator with the Chargers, got let go, and they brought him in, and they made him not the defensive coordinator, but the assistant head coach for defense, and basically put him in charge of the secondary. They let go of their DBs coach, Marcus Robertson. And they think that Pagano is a guy that's going to really help them kind of learn to just grow back there in that defensive backfield. Because if they can avoid giving up the big plays, that's kind of the mantra of this defense. As long as they don't give up big plays, with the offense they have, they're good enough to beat you. And that's basically going to be the goal going into this year.
That bend but don't break philosophy. A lot of teams certainly subscribe to that school of thought that you just laid out, Jimmy. On the topic of youth that my partner here, John, just alluded to in his last question, I'm looking at the Raiders' recent draft history, and I think that's a big reason why this franchise has turned things around. And a big national story this offseason has been the Raiders trying to lock up their 2014 draft picks. They gave an extension to Derek Carr. They just worked one out with Gabe Jackson. I'm assuming Khalil Mack is the next guy on the platter, even though I believe they did pick up his fifth-year option. How big was the 2014 draft, Jimmy, when you look back in terms of really shaping the direction of this franchise right now?
I mean, it was a complete franchise changer. I mean, it has a potential to go down as, you know, one of the best drafts in their franchise's history because, I mean, it brought them out of the darkness of all these years of, you know, they hadn't made the playoffs since 2002. And, you know, what are the two biggest positions that if you can find an impact player at that you want to go for? Pass rusher and quarterback, and to be able to get Khalil Mack in the first round, and you know, and that was kind of a no-brainer pick when he was around. And then to have Derek Carr fall to you in round two and turn into a guy that, if you're redrafting right now, he's probably the number one overall pick.
Yeah,
you can't overstate the value of that. I mean, that to be able to get a guy like that in the second round, and obviously, you know, at the salary he's been making the last couple of years, now that goes up, but be able to have a guy like that, you know, making as little as he was, that allowed them really to go out and get guys like Kelechi Osemele last offseason, Rodney Hudson two offseasons ago, bring in Prusserv and Deshaun Smith. So, I mean, it completely changed the franchise to finally get them a quarterback that they can build around. And, I mean, it certainly will be one that Reggie McKenzie will never forget because it's going to be a draft that's going to be talked about as potentially legendary when you look at really those first three guys, because Gabe Jackson's been a heck of a of an offensive guard for him too.
Is there any residual effect from Carr's injury at the end of the year, or is he participating in OTAs and minicamp?
Yeah, he's been full go ever since. Ever since everything's been started, once they got on the field, he had no limitations. He got really lucky that it was a pretty clean break, no real residual damage, and he's been able to. I mean, he's kind of forgotten about it. I've almost kind of forgotten about it at this point. He's 100%, and he'll be good to go for training camp and everything.
Did he have to have surgery, or was that just rest?
Yeah, he did have surgery.
Okay.
He had, I think, a rod put in there, but it healed up quick. I mean, he was, he was walking around on it, running around on it pretty quickly.
Jimmy, last one for me. Since the Giants do play the entire AFC West, we've had a lot of conversations about what you think the division is going to look like and how much depth is going to be showcased. The Raiders were running away with things, unfortunately, until Derek Carr got hurt, and that caused them to not have such a lengthy postseason run. Denver still has question marks about the quarterback. I think the Chargers could be a team on the rise based on some of the things they made, and the Chiefs have been really the sign of consistency. What do you make of this division, and how competitive do you think it will be this year?
Yeah, I mean, it should be pretty wide open. The only team that's struggled in recent years is the Chargers, and probably at least 60% of that is just they can't stay healthy. I mean,
yeah.
The Chargers could find a way to avoid the catastrophic injury after injury after injury that they've had the last few years, I think they would have been right up there, you know, at least fighting for 500. And I mean, because when you have as many good teams in the division, it's hard for everybody to have a winning record. But I mean, I think anybody really could win this division. The Raiders, to me, feel like the favorite just because of what they've added and you know, the way Derek Carr and Amari Cooper and all those guys, Khalil Mack, continue to progress. But you certainly can't count out the way the Chiefs, you know, are just so consistent. And they seem to have the Raiders' number, especially under Jack Del Rio. They're 4-0 against the Raiders the last 2 years. And you've got to respect that. Andy Reid really games plans well, especially against these Raiders. And I mean, the Broncos still have some ferocious guys on defense. And you know, if their quarterback position can get into shape, if one of those guys can really take control and lead that offense, then they're dangerous. I mean, it's a dangerous division, and should be a lot of fun games to watch.
Final question for me: I asked you about expectations of the fan base at the start of this interview, Jimmy. How about the enthusiasm? Are these Raider fans completely turned off by their imminent move to Las Vegas, or are they going to be out there in force, full-throated, selling out the building, big game, you know, against the Broncos in December, going bananas and making life hell for the opponents. What is that dynamic going to be like? Because to me, it seems like it's going to have to be just a little bit awkward, no?
Yeah, it's going to be a little strange. I mean, one thing that helps them is that, you know, the fans that they do draw to their games already, you know, come from such a kind of wide-ranging area. I mean, there's a lot of fans that still drive up from L.A. every weekend, drive up from the Central Valley of California. And for them, the fact that they're moving really doesn't change anything for them because, you know, Vegas is probably closer or just as close to where they're at. So a lot of fans have the mantra of it doesn't matter where this team's at, we're going to root for them. But, I mean, there's certainly a large group of the Oakland loyalists that may still go to the games, but, you know, you might see some anti-Mark Davis signs there. I still think the environment will be pretty good. It may tame down a little bit, but we all know what's going to matter the most is are they winning. If they're winning and being successful, teams will, you know, fans will kind of be able to forget about it a little bit. They'll be able to just, you know, try to hope and root for their team to win a title before they get out of there. And, I mean, they've sold out all their season tickets, so you got to figure the stands are going to be packed. But it has potential, especially if they don't play as well, to start going south a little bit.
Real quick follow-up, is there any chance of another team winding up in Oakland at some point? Or is just the whole inability of the professional sports teams, and I'll include the Athletics in that, to come to an agreement with the city on a stadium, is that just going to permanently keep any football team out of the Oakland area?
You know, I think it'd be pretty hard for them to put another team in Oakland. I think if another team ever came to the Bay Area, it would be to share Levi Stadium with the 49ers. I mean, that stadium was built and set up, and, you know, the leases and all that are arranged for it to possibly host two teams.
Oh,
and
I didn't know that.
I don't think Oakland would really welcome another team other than the Raiders. If you tried to give them an expansion team, you know, I think half of Oakland would still be like, "Nah, we're still with the Raiders." So I don't think another team coming into that city is going to happen. I do think the NFL will kind of, you know, we know the NFL always wants to have some city, some option out there to float out to scare Jacksonville and all those other cities into upgrading or building new stadiums. So there will be, you know, over the years, there'll be flirtations with, oh, well, we can move to Santa Clara and be the second team. And maybe they would, you know, move that second team into practice at the Raiders' old facility and kind of brand them as the Oakland team. But I don't think you'll ever see another team, you know, anytime soon playing in the city limits.
Thank you, Jimmy. We appreciate the time, my friend. Great stuff. And enjoy your last couple weeks of freedom before the players show up in a couple weeks. All right?
Yeah, thanks so much, Jimmy. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks a lot, guys.
There he goes, Jimmy Durkin, Bay Area News Group, does a fantastic job, good information, good stuff. And I do think it's interesting. I didn't realize that Levi Stadium was set up that way, to be ready to host two teams at the same time. Makes sense.
It does.
I mean, given how it's just been – I mean, the A's have been trying to get a new stadium for, 20 years, trying to get out of the Coliseum, but it's impossible. So, I mean, that makes sense. I don't know. Do you think the NFL is going to expand more? I mean, I feel like it's set up so...
Well, they're at an ideal number right now.
It's so perfect with the 32 and the 16 and 16 and the bye weeks. I mean, this thing couldn't be set up better, no?
Yeah, if you're going to expand, I think you got to add two teams.
Oh, at least.
So I right now don't see them being in that position to do that. So.
And you have London that they've talked about if a team's going to move.
But that, to me, is just pure speculation at this point.
Yeah, I just mean in terms of a team wants to relocate. I mean, I think London's a place that the league would prioritize in trying to get a team to move there at some point. Maybe not ready yet, but at some point. St. Louis is without a team now as well. They're good sports town, though they've had trouble supporting NFL teams. And then you have Oakland. So San Diego is another.
But remember, all of these, it's funny, all of these cities and locations that you're talking about, the reason why they're losing teams is because of the stadium. So in order for them to have a team relocate there, they'd have to settle the stadium issue.
Which, ironically enough, has been known to happen. Look at the Browns.
It gives them some ammunition. When you lose a team, then all of a sudden you start to be a little bit more aggressive in finding the necessary money, the private funding to go out and
Baltimore
get a stadium.
Why did Baltimore lose the Colts? And all of a sudden they got the Ravens. Why did Cleveland lose the Browns? And all of a sudden the Browns came back. Or they had the
expansion. No, it has been cyclical from that standpoint.
I mean, it's interesting. I don't know.
But I do think he brings up a good point about the fact that you have such a transient group of fans that support the Raiders.
It was a very good point.
That moving to Vegas really doesn't change things other than, yes, the people that are embedded in Oakland. And I do think, on a side note, I think the Marshawn Lynch part of that, which I don't think a lot of people are talking about, I also think it was a good PR move because he's an Oakland native. And who better to showcase during a season when there's that awkwardness that you referred to, than having the native son be perhaps the big appeal in the running part.
And I also think if you show up and you put a truth detector, a lie detector on Mark Davis, I don't think he wanted to leave Oakland. I don't think he wanted to. I think he felt like, you know, in modern economics the way they are, it's something that he had to do. And it's unfortunate, but like he said, I mean, the Raiders are just such a, you know, they already left Oakland once before to go to L.A., and the Oakland fans stuck with them. So I think it's a little bit different than, you know, Cleveland, the Browns leaving Cleveland. It's never happened before. You know, it's part of the society. The Raiders already left Oakland once. And it's not like, I mean, Vegas is drivable from Oakland. It's kind of a nightmare, but you can do it. It's like 4 hours, I think, or something like that. But, it is what it is.
The appeal is you have some other things to do and you can make it a whole weekend. Meaning if you're going to do the 4 hours, you go out there maybe on a Friday, you make the most of it, and then you wrap it up with the game on Sunday.
I think everyone wants to hear your list of top Vegas hotspots.
Oh, absolutely. If there's anybody to get recommendations from, it's certainly me in that regard.
Last time I was in Vegas, you know, they put outside the clubs all the people that are featured on a weekly basis.
Oh, did they?
Yeah,
really?
You were popping up.
I didn't realize that. You know, if they're using my image, you should let me know that because then there may be some legalities that we need to negotiate and so forth on that side of things. But, yes, it should be fun when they eventually do get to Vegas, which won't be for a few seasons. Remember, that was delayed, too, because of the construction of the stadium. And I don't know if you heard.
What year are they showing up in Vegas now officially?
I think it may be 20. It may be 20.
And the Rams are 20 also now, too, right?
Because that was delayed because of the rainfall.
Correct.
In the Los Angeles area. The Raiders situation is more of, you know, the parking now is becoming an issue. I don't know if you heard the latest thing yet.
No, what's that?
The parking, they don't feel as if they're going to have enough parking around the new stadium.
It's in the middle of the desert. What the hell is in the way? Sand?
Apparently, there is not enough space to put together a parking lot that is sizable enough to house everybody. So, wait till you hear this. They're going to then use the parking area for the UNLV stadium, which is about 3 miles away from the new stadium. And they're going to provide shuttles so people who park at the UNLV stadium can then have transportation to get to the stadium. But you know the whole key to go to a game is you want a tailgate. And now you put all that crap in your car.
Bad idea.
What are you going to do? You're going to jump on the shuttle and take the barbecue and everything else with you? I mean, can you imagine that's going to be like?
I'm pretty familiar with Vegas geography. I've been there a number of times. I'm trying to think of...
Well, excuse me. You're telling me that I was a frequent person.
I was busting on you.
I know you were. No.
And I'm trying to figure out, 3 miles away from the UNLV stadium, I guess it would have been on that side of the strip by, like, the Palm and stuff like that. That's interesting. I've never actually looked on a map to see where they're going to build the thing. But, I mean, there's so... That really boggles. Unless they're putting it on the strip, which I know they're not.
No, they're not. Yeah.
How do they not have enough space? I don't have the thing up here, Dave. I'm sorry.
I think you may need to consult with the Vegas officials because you seem to be a pro when it comes to the layout of the land. But there, if memory serves me correct, from just looking at the layout, I think aren't we talking about the area that's not too far from the airport?
See, Dave has it. Here we go. The stadium is right on the strip, the equivalent of downtown. Everyone knows already within walking distance. There we go. That makes sense then. But again, people staying at the casinos, they don't necessarily have to bring their car from the casino. They actually have the monorail, too, that goes up and down the strip that you can take places. I didn't realize the stadium was being built right on the strip.
Yeah, but
here's what side of the strip is being built on, Dave? Is it by, like, the Wynn and the Encore, or is it the other side? Okay, Dave's going to give me a link here.
He's going to give you, okay.
Yeah.
Well, in the meantime, though, I understand that in terms of the convenience for people that are coming from out of town and they're in Vegas. But then you have to take into consideration the ones who are maybe commuting from L.A. or commuting from Oakland and maybe they're actually going to drive and they're not going to fly and they're going to bring all of the hoopla to the game. So those are the ones that I think are going to have the hard time.
That's a good point. Let me see if I have a proposed site here for the Raiders Las Vegas.
Who knew we were going to do more homework about the Raiders on this program than the New York Giants?
I'm curious now. Like I said, I'm fairly familiar with Las Vegas.
Well, I didn't think you were going to be so passionate on this subject.
I'm not passionate. I'm curious.
Yes.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, wow. We're really bringing up the photos here.
I got a map here.
Let me see if I could find that story that I was reading too.
Boy, yeah, they have like they don't have it in relation to the strip here where it would be. Eh, it's all right. It's not that important. It's more my personal curiosity than anything.
Well, yeah, here's an image of what the new stadium is going to look like. So, I mean, technically,
I guess that would be the strip over there.
That would be that section
you have
of
it
the
there?
Strip.
Thank you,
yeah.
Dave. I appreciate it. We're going to put this in here, and we're going to take a look to see where it's going to be at. Always have faith in our excellent producer, Dave Dominic, to figure this out. Here we go. So it is down by, like, the Hard Rock and the Luxor on that side, down towards where the Palm is. Okay. Yeah, that isn't far from the Strip. I'm not sure if that's walkable, though, Dave. Especially in September in that Vegas heat, man. Whew.
Well, that's the thing. And that's why there's the big issue. It's not just so much that the parking area for right. UNLV is 3 miles away. It's also, like you said, there are people who are even in the neighborhood going to want to walk. And if you see that image, John, that's a very small parking space area. If you just look around the vicinity,
and
I mean, that's nothing compared to even what you have here at MetLife Stadium.
And there is a decent, and there are, I didn't realize it was that close to the Strip. There isn't a ton of land that close to the Strip. If you went on the other side of the highway, there would actually be a lot of space. But anyway, I don't want to get into the geography anyway. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Tomorrow, Jeff Fiegel's on the Cardinals. I'm going to draw straws with Lance to see which one of us hosts with Fiegel's. And we'll see who wins. For Lance Meadow, I'm John Chevelle. Again, for our excellent producer, Dave Dominic. Hope you enjoyed Big Blue Kickoff Live today on Giants.com. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a good day.
Have a good one.